Tonight on Arena, Tipperary 1970 is the setting for Donald Ryan's new novel, Sophie Gorman Reviews, and the RTE National Symphony Orchestra finally live on stage again. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Fans of classical music will be delighted to know that a new 12-part series will see the RTE National Symphony Orchestra live streaming worldwide on RTE Culture and broadcasting on RTE Lyric FM starting this Friday evening. Live from the stage of the National Concert Hall, David Brophy, who was in with us last week, wasn't it? Yes. Will be conducting works including Mozart's Second Flute Concerto with principal flautist of the orchestra, Katrina Ryan, who is with me in studio this evening, who actually whooped when I said...
Of course I whooped. It's very exciting.
We spoke to some of the members of the RTE Concert Orchestra as well, Katrina, at the time that they were getting ready for... those first set of performances together.
It's so emotional.
And for an orchestra.
I know.
You just can't survive without each other.
I know.
Really.
Who knew? I think it's going to be fantastic when we get back together. The only problem will be we won't be able to hug each other because we want to even more than we would ever have wanted to. But yeah, I mean, it was very difficult to suddenly not have an outlet. Mm. You just never really thought about it as a musician. You know, you need, not only is it part of you and you're expressing another side of yourself that you maybe couldn't put into words and maybe wouldn't always be socially acceptable to put into words. So it's a wonderful outlet to have as a human being to play an instrument. So if anyone's listening and they're thinking of taking one up, do it. But also, as a team of people, we need each other so much and we feed off each other when we're playing, and that whole communication was lost too. And that finally, maybe the most important thing, we had no audience. There was nobody, we couldn't perform. And if we could perform, our audience weren't allowed to come. And that was just, mind blowing for us. It really made me realise really early on that how important an audience is.
Yeah. And in fact, I was looking at it. It's on the RTE National Symphony Orchestra Facebook page. a post that you made, was it March?
That was such a sincere post because I actually hadn't been very well and I'd been out for 3 weeks. I'd had to have a small operation and I'm fine. But so my lockdown was even longer than anyone else's.
So explain, because that post, I have to say, I looked at it today and even here we are in the month of September celebrating the orchestra back. Yeah. And I thought, it was really emotional. It was a very heartfelt plea from you.
It was so sincere. I genuinely meant every word of it. And I'm a little embarrassed watching it back now because it was so sort of raw. But yeah, I was really just wanted, I felt for our audience, there are people who are so supportive of us. We have a subscription series normally and, we see the same people coming along every week. Supporting, it's like having, your own cheerleader squad and they mightn't be jumping up and down with pom-poms, but they mean that much to us. And I just suddenly felt for them, especially the older generation, that they were told to stay at home like everybody was, but they particularly were. Yeah. And I just felt like they might like to hear a little bit of music and to know that we missed them and to know that it meant.
What you said in the post that really struck me was, you were there and you're holding the flute and you're saying, look, I miss you all and I hope you're all doing well. And look, we all have to be in this together, which is very much, there was that great sense of a community together at that point. But you said, you just said, looked out straight to the camera, your phone as it was, one point, and you said, I have nobody to play to.
I know. It's like it struck me. It just struck me that week. Wow, I didn't know I needed this so much. And maybe that's selfish, but I found it really heartening over the lockdown to see how appreciated those little videos were, because the orchestra, everyone in the orchestra went on to make loads of little videos, which was brilliant. So all over the social media channels for the RTE NSO, videos of all kinds, and they got more and more intricate and more advanced. And my husband, Ronan O'Reilly, helped me do one with the flute trio. So we had the three flute players and jumping around in boxes. And, it became great fun and people were very creative and inventive. So,
But did I detect, when you finished, you played the Coolin, you played it.
Very straightforward and quite fast.
You played it. And when you got to the end of it, I thought, you just about made it to the phone and got the stop button pressed. Were there tears shed?
I can't actually remember. I don't know if there actually were, but that's kind of my point I was making earlier. You also you almost shed them through the flute, so you don't maybe need to cry as much.
So, the flute does that work for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, it can do. It's like therapy.
did I hear it? I mean, wind instruments are a particular difficulty, obviously, because
aerosols.
The air is going through mm-hmm. them, apart from anything else. And there's also quite often water particles within the instrument as well. Is the flute particularly difficult
the worst,
one to control?
Apparently, the flute is the worst wind instrument. Other than singing, I think it's the worst form of music to be involved in.
Why is that? Do you know?
Well, I do know because, and I'm delighted I've been vindicated because I've always said that we use more air than any of the other wind instruments, and it's been proven. No, yeah. Basically, it's to bring it back to very simple language, it's like blowing across the top of a bottle, which probably a lot of listeners have done to make a sound. So roughly 50% of your air goes out into the room or into the wherever you are, and the other 50% goes into the sound, into the instrument to make the sound. It splits on the sharp edge of the blowhole, for a non-technical term. But so because that 50% is going out with force, the force that you're blowing into the instrument, it goes farther than the other wind instruments.
And possibly it's like a cough then or a sneeze. That's the kind of danger that is. So clearly when you're performing on Friday night, all this, the social distances is more important than ever.
No, I was in there. I have to say thank you to RTE for being so careful. I mean, we got very frustrated with them at one point. I have to say the musicians of the orchestra were itching to get back. You know, like I said, it's what we do. It's what we're born to do. It's what most of us have always wanted to do with our lives. And we just couldn't really understand why we couldn't come back in some form and why would they not let us? And while it was frustrating, I'm very grateful to them for looking after us. And also, God, I sound so sycophantic, but you know, also really grateful to them and to NCH, National Concertal Management, our management, particularly in the orchestra and staff, for getting us back because it's not been easy. It hasn't.
If people go to the Facebook page, they'll see how it's only 35 members of the orchestra.
I heard 37, but maybe it's 35 plus conductor plus
and
soloist.
You're the soloist in the flute concerto here in this particular. Let's have a listen to you. Was this back in what you recorded this back with? Not in the quartet. I want to save that for a little bit.
Okay, this is 2017 then. Yeah. I think June. It was a live radio broadcast, so forgive any flaws.
So, and this is the same flute concerto.
It's the same concerto, but it was the final movement, the rondo.
So let's have a little listen. It'd be the orchestra to start out. Oh, it was you.
Yes, the RTE NSO.
That's all the orchestra, so we can take it out of this. Just a little bit from the final movement, did you tell me?
The
rondo movement from the second flute concerto of Mozart. And that is the piece, Katrina Ryan, that you will be playing live on Friday night. I suppose Mozart kind of suits the slightly smaller forces, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, because it's smaller forces, you know, the symphony orchestra would normally play huge, rambunctious repertoire, Mahler symphonies and Strauss tone poems. And they're amazing.
60, 70 people on stage.
Yeah, exactly, and more sometimes. Mm. But obviously we can't do that. So in order to get back to playing, we have to adhere to regulations. And that means 35 will fit with social distancing on the National Concertal stage. So yeah, that the really obvious repertoire that works for that size orchestra is classical repertoire, and Mozart is, you know.
Yeah, as
Mozart,
opposed
Beethoven.
To the big romantic stuff, which needs...
Some of it will work, but
the bigger forces are really needed for the high romance later into the 19th century, I guess. That particular piece of music, Mozart wrote two flute concertos, wasn't it?
He wrote one in G major. He was commissioned to write, I think, three concertos. He was in Mannheim at the time. There we are. Mm. And he wrote the G major and then got a bit lazy, got a bit tired. And he reworked the oboe concerto he'd previously written and put it up a tone, changed some very small corners and presented it to the commissioner. And
Now, was that because he was lazy or was he just not a fan of the
flute? I heard that. I knew you'd bring this up.
Of course.
How could anyone not love the flute? It's beautiful.
Well, Mozart mightn't have done.
I think, well, apparently he took flute lessons, so maybe he didn't love it because he found it difficult. Oh, it's right. Not always, if you're not, don't have a natural embouchure on the flute, it's not the most fun to play.
That being putting your mouth across that blowhole, yeah, in the right way.
Exactly. Some people find it easy and some people don't. It depends on the shape of your mouth and your teeth. Yeah. And all of that.
So the excitement then of actually being out front, because you won't be in the midst of the audience, you'll actually be out front.
Excitement / terror, but yes. It's an interesting, it's a bit of a seismic mental shift when you're in the orchestra to step forward, to be soloist. So I'm actually really grateful that it's the first concert I'm doing back since the break, after such a long break, because I don't have to think about that. I'm going in as the soloist, and next week I'll be back in my proper seat. You know, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be asked. I'm really lucky. There are so many flute players who would love to play this concerto with the National Symphony Orchestra. So
you're happy to be down there.
I'm relishing it. With some trepidation.
Now, I spoke about your Facebook post at the very, I think it was March, I think it was March was the date of that. I also have a little recording here with you playing all four parts. So this is, when you got into lockdown full on, you kind of saw it.
Yeah, this is much more recent.
Right, so what did you do here? This is a divertimento.
I just recorded each part separately, and it's possible with wizardry, sorcery and pro tools to combine them together. And my lovely husband, again, he's getting a second mention. I'm doing well. Helped me to combine the audio. And I also have videos, but they're for another day. So I'm playing first flute, second flute, alto flute and bass flute.
So this last two that you mentioned there are slightly bigger than the usual concert
exactly. flute
that we would
see. Bass flute is a full octave lower. So it's pretty
much
huge.
Bigger.
It curves around because you wouldn't be able to get your hands.
And did you give out to your husband about either the second flautist, the third flautist or the fourth flautist in this performance?
He was very diplomatic.
All four flautists were perfect, were they?
After he finished working with them, they were, yes.
Well, listen, great to see you, Katrina. And
I'm
sure you're delighted to be back. Lots of people will be delighted.
So delighted.
It'll be even better
so
when we can get in there and sit, even if it's socially distanced. It
hopefully,
would be lovely.
We can't wait, but we'll still be playing for the audience even if they're not there.
Absolutely. And it will be live, so they'll be, it won't be recorded. Let's have a little listen to that flute quartet, and I'll give people details of where they can listen to the concert on Friday evening. There you go, Katrina Ryan on concert flute, Katrina Ryan on concert flute, Katrina Ryan on alto flute, and Katrina Ryan on bass flute in that performance there, recorded over lockdown. All of the parts clearly played by Katrina. You can hear her again as she is part of the season, which I know lots of people will be delighted to hear the orchestra back on stage. The RT National Symphony Orchestra live starts this Friday, the 11th of September, direct from the National Concert Hall, live streamed worldwide in HD, no less, high definition. You can watch it on RTE Culture, rte.ie/culture, and it's broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM.
Woo-hoo.
Fridays at 7 p.m. Anyway, we let that bit go. The Fringe Festival, which runs until September the 20th, has this year partnered with the ARC, a cultural centre for children in Temple Bar in Dublin. Artists Andy Field and Becky Darlington have recorded voices of children across Ireland and the UK, articulating their feelings about the world they live in and how they would like to change it for the better. They have combined those recordings into an audio track, guiding listeners on an interactive walk in the rain as part of this year's festival. Here's a sample.
The rain is soft and silky. It's cold and is falling in large chunks. And it doesn't slide off your arms. It stays there in little raindrops. Some bits of the rain are larger and some are smaller. And it falls heavily and sometimes it falls lightly. This is the rain.
Where in England are you?
I am in London, specifically on the top side of Victoria Park. Odd question, but do you have any sort of lakes near you?
I have a pond in my back garden and I have the sea everywhere around me. Are you near the sea?
Definitely not. Have you ever seen around a lot of stars in the sky?
No. I have some things I want to ask you. Is the rain slow or fast?
Is the rain falling on you cold? Is the rain falling on you heavy?
During lockdown, did you stay in your house or did you go outside for walks a lot?
Do you have any happy memories of being in the rain? Do you have any sad memories of being in the rain?
An excerpt there from A Rain Walk, featuring voices of children across Ireland and the UK. And that interactive project was put together by artists Andy Field and Becky Darlington for this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. You can find out more details on fringefest.com. Set in a small Tipperary village in the 1970s, Strange Flowers is the eagerly anticipated new novel from Donal Ryan, his fifth since The Spinning Heart was published in 2012, to much acclaim, it has to be said. This new novel tells the story of the Gladney family, the sudden disappearance of their 20-year-old daughter, Moll, and her equally mysterious return home 5 years later. Sophie Gorman has been reading it for us and she joins me now from Paris. When you hear the setup for that initially, the disappearance, the mysterious disappearance and sudden disappearance of a 20-year-old daughter, you get the impression that I thought initially, is Donal Ryan heading down some kind of thriller route? But it doesn't stay there for very long, Sophie, thought.
You've also, thankfully, I haven't been the one to spoil it this time, but you've also given away the fact that she does return. This is not a thriller about whether or not she will ever return and try and find her.
I think that's all over the book anyway, that she returns. I don't think we're giving too much away.
No, exactly. No, it's not giving anything away because it's very early on. And it's important actually to say that it's not about whether or not she's returning. It's about who returns and what she returns to, because her parents, Kit and Paddy Gladney, when they discover she's gone, they are aghast. They live in a very small rural town. It's a parish of Knockagowney. Near the biggest town nearby is Nina, and she just disappears. And they make very discreet inquiries because it's a very intimate parish, and they don't really want to go around asking where is their daughter. So they discreetly find out that she took a bus to Nina, and then they follow her path and they go to Dublin. And then they discover that she took a train to Dublin. But then the search goes cold and they also go cold about it. They don't really want to know what happened next. And then she returns.
Yeah, I guess the fact that this was set in the 1970s and that a young woman in her early 20s, or is she exactly 20, I think, in fact, when she disappears. The time is important here, the time setting, the historical period is important here. A young woman disappearing like that usually meant a couple of things that wouldn't have been wanted in 1970s Ireland.
That's it. And they obviously were thoughts, about was she pregnant? Was she running, escaping from a situation like that? That they couldn't really countenance, but at the fact they realised that everyone else was thinking these thoughts, and of course it's very much, this is a very small village that is very much a town where gossip moves fast, and it's somewhere a town of judgment and squinting windows, and this, they are a very Catholic Kit and Paddy, and Paddy is 61 when we meet him, and he's an old 61. He's a bone weary 61, and they don't really want to bring all the questions to their door, so they almost let it lie that she's gone, without really inquiring too much. And then she returns, and actually Molly is an interesting character throughout the book, because even she's the fulcrum, she's at the center of everything, and yet we don't know very much about her until ultimately we do. But for most of the book, she's outside everything. But the Moll who returns is definitely a darker Moll than they knew before. She's got a hardness, and she's a remoteness. And she's also very good at ignoring all the unasked questions. She doesn't invite them, so she remains outside of them and doesn't provide the answers.
Yeah, and then the other aspect that's vital to this here, again, because this is what the novel is about, which is why we're not giving anything away and saying she returns. It's not just that she returns, but she is then followed by others. And I suppose the strange flowers of the title, there has to be some kind of nod here towards Strange Fruit, the song, I would have thought.
Exactly. Well, there are key themes. I mean, she is obviously a strange flower in herself, because she's outside of the village life. She never belonged. She doesn't fit in with the typical village women and girls, even though as a child we don't know her before she left, because it begins with her leaving. But she's described by her parents as very much, and in the book she's described as, you know, very much a loving, obedient child, which makes her disappearance all the more unexpected. But she is definitely one of the strange flowers. And then the other key one, and I hope it's okay to say this, is she's followed by Alexander, who is a black Englishman, the only black man this village has ever seen. In fact, I would imagine the whole district has ever seen. And as you said, it's rural Ireland in the 1970s. So this is quite a change of it. He's definitely one of the strange flowers. I actually think that most of the characters, even Paddy and Kit to a degree, are strange flowers, because they're all outsiders looking in. They don't really belong in the way that, you know, they're not fitting in with the squinting windows, the parish, you know, they're outsiders who fit in as much as they need to fit in to get along.
But how does the village, and how do the Valley of the Squinting Windows aspect of things, how is the arrival of this young black man, how is that handled? How do they treat him?
This is one of the bits that is quite peculiar in the way that Donal Ryan has written this. Is this must have been a huge shock if a black man arriving into a small rural town, an English man, to make it even worse, so to speak, in the 1970s in Ireland. But he's very much, I think, the father Paddy plays a pivotal part in this. He accepts him from the beginning. And then so does all the community. And he's even playing hurling quite quickly. And there's throughout the book, there are issues like this which are quite shocking, you would imagine, to a community like this. But they find a resolution and they're resolved.
Is that believable that 1970s of Ireland would have been as accepting as that?
I certainly struggled with that, because I think that, you know, the Donal has introduced very big issues into this book. We have very weighty issues and themes such as racism and sexism and homophobia. And for me, they're too pat, the resolutions for those issues, that people just seem to accept everything in a way that even in contemporary Ireland, now in rural Ireland, in urban Ireland, I think there's still struggles. And I found the fact that that Alexander and his family could be woven into the community in such a way, I found that was a little bit unconvincing, I have to admit.
Donal Ryan wrote this started writing it, I believe, very shortly after the sudden and unexpected death of his father. Does that make its way into the book in any way, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Fatherly love is a key element of this, and how a father will sacrifice anything for a child. Indeed, mothers and their maternal instincts are much less evident throughout. And there's both, I think Ryan Donal, there's a beauty in the way that he describes fathers and indeed Irish men. He really relishes in their gentleness. In terms of the fathers here, we really see that they're made foolish almost by their blinding love. But it is a glory. I mean, there's a glorious celebration of Irish fathers and fathers in Donal's telling in this book. And it's very much a celebration, I would imagine, of his own father. And because this is written, it's Donal's heartland, you know, it's set in rural. He grew up, was born in Nina himself and grew up there and in the 70s. So this is very much his field, his, you know, his land. And he describes them as people who are familiar with his other books will know. He has a very poetic way of writing that is almost oral, that when you're reading his sentences, particularly when he's describing landscapes, you are hearing them read aloud, which is a way of really capturing it. And that is very beautiful. And yes, this was the fact that there's a slight blinkering, it must be admitted, in the way that he describes Irish men. They seem almost faultless, but apart from one character who carries all the faults of Irish men, but the rest of them seem he's celebrating one element of them, that's for certain.
And in typical Donal Ryan form, not only does it have that lyrical language, but it's a short book. I think it comes in and around 200 pages. I read an interview where he said, "I wouldn't ask anybody, you want to be a very good writer, to ask them to stay with the book for longer than a couple of hundred pages." Did the book work for you? You've expressed some caveats there, I think, Sophie. Did the book work for you?
Well, much of it works, but I think there is a problem from the way of this simplifying lives and also of situations. I think he wanted to encompass too much in the book. And then as a result of that, we unfortunately don't get enough about the characters, not enough nuance. There's too much sunniness and goodness and not enough real exploration of the depths of these characters and why they find themselves in situations. And the resolution is in a way too fast for pretty much every situation. There's an explanation behind it. And sadly, real life, I don't think it works quite like that.
So would you still recommend it as a read, or do you think it fails?
Oh, no. I mean, gosh, it doesn't fail. Fail is a very strong word, but it's possibly not as strong as some of his earlier books. And Donal Ryan is remarkable in that, as you say, in 8 years, he's produced 5 novels and a collection of short stories. Yeah. And he's been long listed for the Booker Prize twice. And he does try new things. We had the Low and Quiet, From a Low and Quiet Heart, his last novel, which was about a Syrian doctor who, with his wife and daughter, fled the country and collapsing into war and trying to find hope in Europe. So he tries new things. And this is returning more to the familiar, the landscape of his earlier books and successes. I think it hasn't quite, the characters haven't quite come to full life.
So yes, but with those caveats that you've expressed, that's Sophie Gorman talking to us there about Strange Flowers, the latest book from Donal Ryan, which is published by Doubleday. Underwave from artist Bettina Seitz is an underwater exhibition representing successive arrivals to our shores, from the earliest settlers through to more recent arrivals and people who have contributed to our modern multicultural society. The exhibition was filmed underwater in Sligo Bay and is available to view online. And Bettina joins us now from our Sligo studio. I've said the word underwater a few times there.
Yeah,
hi, Bettina. I probably should have more surprise in my voice. To make an exhibition underwater cannot be an easy task, but maybe let's start out with this idea. Why did you want to make Underwave in the first place? What was the inspiration to have these figures, which we'll describe later, underwater?
Okay, the whole thing kind of started with the fact that the Thread Softly Festival kind of is all based on the landscape and its mythology and history, and it fosters collaborations between artists. And I've been involved in projects with the festival before, the Walk in Birds Mountain projects in 2018, 2019. Also like making sand sculptures in Nine Queens, making sand sculptures in Sligo on the beaches. And it was kind of fitting, like this involvement with the landscape was kind of fitting well with my own work, which had kind of started making some site responsive kind of exhibitions, but they were kind of located in a town, Sligo town. And after that, like, you know, I had the idea, I'd love to bring this out into the landscape. And the fact that this kind of ghost figures that I started kind of creating with the Trembling Veil exhibition in 2015. It just kind of bringing them to the sea, like, was just an idea that kind of caught me, like, you know, just discussing it with the producer from the Threat Sorcery Festival, that just to bring it into a different realm.
Yeah, so, I mean, fine, a sculptor outside in the town is one thing. Even sand sculptors, and we can, you know, we all know that sand sculptors are done on the beach and after a certain period of time they disappear. But to try to put something that's going to last, survive any length of time underwater is quite a task. What exactly say so? What are the figures that you have made? What are they made from, and how do they? First of all, how did you even go about putting them there? What are the figures? Let's start with that.
Well, the figures, like, they're hollow. They're just kind of like ghostly kind of figures. You know, I cast them over myself. So you can feel the essence of a person that was in that kind of figure, and being based on that, around that theme of the ghosts, and also inspired by the kayak and all these mythological figures. The challenge was then putting them in the sea, like, to find a material that was actually durable and would survive the tide coming in and going out. And so usually I work in a jasmonite resin that wasn't suitable because I wouldn't have lasted under the water, and the concrete would have been too heavy, other materials I use. So just kind of made this investigation into the wax, and luckily enough found this kind of wax called carnauba wax, which is a plant-based wax, and it just worked.
The sea, I presume, wears it down, erodes it eventually, but it does last for a period of time underwater, this particular wax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does, like, it's seemingly the hardest wax that there is in the world. Like,
that's how it can last. So you're making these ghostly figures. Are they life size, Bettina?
Yeah, they're not full figures. They're kind of half figures, but they are in life size proportions. So it's basically like a cloak.
Yeah, and I saw them online. I was looking at some of them online today, and they almost look as if they're these wax figures with sackcloth over them. But is the sackcloth made from the same wax, and just it looks like sackcloth, or how does that? What is that?
Okay, it's the wax melted, and then there's actually cotton fabric dipped into the wax. So they're made in three layers. Like, I have two layers of fabric, and in between it's like a sandwich layer of fishing net, and which I kind of all kind of layer together, and I very quickly have to cast over myself to get into the right shape.
I guess the other aspect then is, how do you put them into the sea and get them so that they're not just, you know, as the tide comes in and out, that they're not just carried out to sea and disappear off to some other coastline in some other part of Ireland, or indeed some other part of the world?
Yeah, no, I had a great production manager there, Morris Power, like, and he worked out the whole system. We did some test runs as well. We had tested one first, left it for overnight, and then we had another test run with two figures, left them for a week just to see if they would survive all. Oh,
yeah. So how many figures then are part of the entire exhibition now, the current underwave that we can see?
There was 11 figures in the end, and so the whole total dimension would have been maybe 17 metres of skeleton bars. You know, they were kind of, Morris had worked out a system. We did a dry run on land first to kind of for the installation, and then had a whole crew of people coming with us to bring it out into the sea. I had to go out at low tide, install it kind of quickly.
That was how you worked the logistics of that. Mm-hmm. The tide's low, you get out, you install it very quickly. Would you get one figure? Would you get more than one figure?
No, we installed it all in a day. Picked it all. Well, sorry, in a few hours.
Yeah.
We had a great site, which is actually like in Sligo, like we have this estuary, like it's over on the way to Coney Island. And it's basically during low tide, it's like a huge sandbank. Which at high tide kind of fills in with water, but we had, Morris had found a channel of the water in there, and so we had access to that for a few hours.
And that was enough time.
A big crew with us, you know, and then it kind of installed it.
And then when the tide actually comes in, the figures are submerged underneath the water, and that's what you filmed.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah. We would, the installation we did this very same day, we did our first test filming basically once the tide had come in. We'd kind of approach the location again, but kind of coming in from Ross's Point direction with the boat. Like, we had two rescue boats from the Sligo Yacht Club. And on the boat, we had Fionn Roger, our filmmaker. And basically just kind of did kind of 15-minute journey maybe to approach it with the boat. And then he kind of spent time filming.
And the other side of this, I presume, is, Bettina, you had to think about the life in the sea, that whatever material you were putting in there was safe for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I consulted with a marine biologist. You know, that's why I kind of did this kind of investigations into the material. And, you know, it was all...
So, and while we can view it on obviously online, I presume we can see it from land as well when the tide is out. Or is there a point at which we can view and see it underneath the water as well?
No, there isn't really. The whole project was kind of designed to be viewed
underwater
via film and online. But the site, I mean, you could see it in the distance. I mean, people could at low tide actually walk to it, but we kind of put it on a site that was not very populated. So, like, we didn't really want to attract that people to the installation.
You want them to look at the film itself
rather than anything else. It was accessible at low tide. You could have gone over it, but we didn't publicise it.
How long will it last before the Caranaba wax is eroded down to nothing? Do you know?
We took them out today and they were still fine, so they've been in there for 10 days. We just left them a few extra days until we kind of took the insulation down. You know, so we'll see. I don't know. I brought them back to the studio today, so we'll just have to see.
Well, the photos, we have some photos on the link on our own Twitter page or at RTE Arena. But that's Bettina Seitz speaking to us there about her exhibition, Underwave. And as well as our own Twitter, you can find it on treadsoftly.ie. And so to our ongoing series, Where Do I Begin With? And this evening, we ask the question about a woman who is both artist and muse, whose talent, like a vocation, has dictated the course of her life and who is considered one of the great songwriters of the 20th century. I'm talking about Joni Mitchell. If you're not sure about Big Yellow Taxi, but you're open to giving her a chance, well then, Rachel Breslin is here to give her advice on where to begin with Joni Mitchell. Just before we get into where you want others to begin, where did you begin with her? I think you've spoken about your own startings with Joni Mitchell being quite chaotic, almost accidental, were they, Rachel?
Yeah, I slipped into it all right. And that's exactly what I want our listeners to do tonight as well. We're talking about a woman with a career spanning over 45 years, and 19 studio albums under her belt. But yeah, like you say, I want the listeners tonight to start with the one that I started with as well. And it's the one that not necessarily my favourite, but the one that most frequently makes the best of lists.
You're talking about Blue. You're talking about the album Blue from 1971. So this is kind of in the middle, if you like. What had she achieved just in because we will go back on the earlier stuff, but what had she achieved up to this point, and what was Blue a real turning point in her career?
Blue, I think, yeah, it's regarded as her seminal album. She certainly had lived a life before Blue. I think it was her third album, third or fourth studio album. But as you said, I came to Blue myself as a teenager. I used to babysit for a neighbour of ours. And as soon as the child was asleep every night, I would go through their CD collection, as it was at the time.
Do they know this, that you were rooting through their records?
They know now, Sean. they certainly invited me to do so. And they had Blue, and even better, they had a great sound system in their living room. And that was it. That was all I played every night that I babysat. And that was the start of my lifelong relationship, my love affair with Joni Mitchell. And Blue is an album, I suppose, what stood out for me on Blue, strangely enough, because what Joni Mitchell is really known for is her guitar playing. She's known for a lot of things, obviously, but it's one thing that stands out. And the songs that stood out for me on Blue were unusually the ones that were piano based. So the song Blue itself and the song River, which we all know it starts with that Christmassy little piano part at the beginning. And both of those songs were ones that I could kind of go home and hammer out on the piano. My 15-year-old self, imagining myself to be living
Joni
these
Mitchell.
Same things that Joni Mitchell was doing. Yeah.
All right. But you've chosen specifically the track A Case of You. Why?
A Case of You, yeah. I guess it encapsulates the honesty and the extreme vulnerability that you can hear on the writing throughout the album. The song is now purportedly about her love affair with Leonard Cohen. That she's never stated that herself, but that's what people take from it. And she talked about the song. She said that she showed it originally to Kris Kristofferson after she first wrote it, A Case of You. And he took one listen to the song and his response was, "Geez, Joni, keep something for yourself." It was just so raw, so vulnerable. He was almost trying to protect her. She was giving away too much.
"You're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on my feet."
That's A Case of You from Joni Mitchell's Blue. Rachel Breslin is with me in studio this evening answering the question, where do I begin with? And in this case, where do I begin with Joni Mitchell? I'm just thinking about the old babysitting. I suppose nice, gentle dulcimer music that we've been hearing there, and that beautiful voice. I mean, her voice is so immediately recognisable. The baby stayed asleep, presumably, during
I don't even know what the baby was doing upstairs. I was so engrossed in this album.
These are things you should not be telling the people you babysat for at the time. Or the baby's going around singing Joni Mitchell now, as a whatever exactly. He or she would be at this point in their life. You mentioned that the Leonard Cohen aspect of that story and Kris Kristofferson saying, keep something for yourself, Joni. There had been a lot of suffering, never mind just heartbreak, but there had been suffering previously, particularly in her early life. She had a difficult childhood with health issues, didn't she?
Yeah, that's right. She had polio as a child and ended up spending an awful lot of time on her own, which possibly contributed to the poet she later became. It gave her lots of time to be introspective, to watch the world go by and to kind of observe the comings and goings, sitting at home, stuck at home in her house, looking through the window. But she did make a full recovery from that and went on to go to art college. Joni Mitchell has always seen herself as a painter primarily, which might come as a surprise to people who don't know her, because she's so known for being a singer-songwriter and so prolific as that. So in college, she was studying painting, and that was where she started to sing as well, because she was studying with all these other painters, but she felt the need to go that bit further, to do something more innovative again, and she took singing to be that thing. So she took up singing in the evenings, but she kind of had this style where she was mimicking her own heroes like Judy Collins and Joan Baez, and she was very good from the get-go. She had a talent that was recognised straight away. But yes, she did have a more difficult things befell her during her college years. She ended up having a baby very, very young, which was ultimately given up for adoption. She made a really difficult and uncommon and unpopular decision for a woman at that time to give the baby up. And this kind of stayed with her throughout her career. She was troubled about it, and she wrote about the daughter that she gave up many times.
And obviously, as you said, there were albums before Blue in 1971, but did Blue really establish her as an artist and build a relationship with her audience that just hadn't been there previous to that?
Yeah, how she established herself really was by singing in the late 60s in the coffee houses in New York. And that was where people of note began to notice her. Firstly, David Crosby of Crosby, Stills and Nash. And he seemed to kind of open up a whole world of other musicians and so on to her at that time. And that was even before she released her first album, Song to a Seagull, which he actually produced. David Crosby produced it. But she was, I guess, her writing was developing all the time at that point, and being exposed to the work of all these other musicians, and indeed hanging out with all these other musicians like James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, it changed her writing a lot. Particularly the Bob Dylan, she talked about the way that Bob Dylan wrote as being different to anything she'd heard before.
And I know you had mentioned as another important track Woodstock from Ladies of the Canyon, but seeing as you're talking, you've spoken about how the writing changed post 1971, maybe we should move on actually to something a little bit later on, Coyote from 1976. What aspect of Joni Mitchell does this song from this album really? Hegira is the album, isn't it? Is that how I say it?
Yeah, I think so. So I guess at this period of time, the 60s and the 70s, there was a theme in songwriting and in poetry and in literature, which was travelling and the open road. And of course, again, I mentioned Dylan. He was the ultimate troubadour. He travelled all over America singing. And we had Jack Kerouac with On the Road, and Leonard Cohen travelling throughout Europe, and Joni herself travelling throughout Europe. But it was mainly men. Joni was uniquely a woman doing these things, exploring the romance of the open road. And that's what she was doing on Hegira. And the song you mentioned, Coyote, is kind of the ultimate life on the road song.
That coyote's at my door. He pins me in a corner, he won't take no. He drags me out on the dance floor, and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got a woman at home. He's got another woman down the hall. He seems to want me anyway. Why'd you have to get so drunk and leave me on that way? You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner out the white lines on the freeway.
And there we go. That's a Coyote there.
When I opened the mic, I was singing. It's impossible not to.
Well, it's maybe impossible not to. Very difficult to, because as we were listening to that, you quite rightly pointed out, write out the lyrics of this song. And you'll simply see, you said rather than me saying what you told me when we were listening there.
It's there are no choruses, there are no verses. It's a stream of consciousness. It's a poem, and it's just beautiful, a piece of art. Yeah.
And that lyrical side of things, were they essentially lyric poems? You know, to what extent, I mean, you think of Big Yellow Taxi, which is a kind of an activism type of song, if you like. To what extent was that, you know, the political aspect very present in her lyrics, or were they all very personal lyrics, do you think?
Yeah, the political element became more and more prevalent as she got a little older, as is the case with lots of artists, in fact. But there were themes that were recurrent throughout her whole career. Like, the most revisited theme in all of her albums, I think, is this desire for love and the desire for freedom and the conflict between the two things. Because I suppose, do you find freedom in a love affair, or does a relationship tie you down? And it's something that she grappled with, in this innate dissatisfaction with her own situation through her whole life.
And Hegira was 1976. She went to kind of, and you were saying again, even as we were listening there, you can hear the beginnings of a jazzier style coming in there. She went a bit further down that road subsequent to Hegira in 1976, didn't she?
Yeah, that's right. She ended up making an album with Charles Mingus, who apparently called her from his deathbed to request that she make an album with him. So that one was called Mingus. Very experimental, much more so than what we've heard there. Yeah.
You at the top of your notes, you have a great quote in terms of what she wanted and people listening to her music, what she wanted to give them. Maybe give us that quote. Oh, sorry, it's here. Well, that you don't. I thought had it in front of you. I'll read it out then, but it's you that passed it on to us. The trick is, if you listen to the music and you see me, you're not getting anything out of it. If you listen and see yourself, it'll make you cry and you'll learn something about yourself. And now you're getting something from it. There's a kind of an altruism, a lack of ego in that, that's extraordinary in many ways.
A lack of ego, but in other ways, she didn't care really what people, I feel that she didn't care what people thought about her. People, and you can even see it now with online discussion forums and so on, people's relationship with Joni Mitchell goes, I think, one of two ways. It's people who want to be her and people who want to be her friend. But loads of people feel like she's just looking into their soul and she knows them better than they know themselves.
It's impossible to talk about Joni Mitchell without playing the song we're going to finish up with, which is Both Sides Now. And this is a version from 2000, so it's very different from maybe from earlier versions that you might have heard. How does this typify her work, do you think? Because this is where you're sending us to as a third possible listen.
Well, what's really incredible about this song, more than anything else, is it's very reflective. The lyrics are reflective, but it's kind of the song that bookended her career, because she sang it as a naive, sort of wiser than her years, 23-year-old. And then she recorded another orchestrated version, as you said, in 2000. And the significance of listening to a much older woman looking back on her life, she really has looked at life from both sides now.
So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds.
Absolutely gorgeous version there of Both Sides Now, then the opening section from Joni Mitchell, a recording from the year 2000. And it was Rachel Breslin who was with us this evening answering the question, where do I begin with Joni Mitchell? That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Karen Dunn was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will talk to you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1.